This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's Wild Oil of Oregano supports a variety of healthy benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Guess what? The theme of this podcast is, you'd be amazed to hear, the coronavirus. Yeah, we're talking a lot about that these days. We're providing a lot of informative perspectives for you on the subject of coronavirus, topic A for Intelligent Medicine these days. And today we're going to talk to one of my favorite colleagues, Dr. Lise Alschuler. Lise has been a frequent contributor to Intelligent Medicine, particularly in view of the fact that she has board certification in naturopathic oncology. She's been a pioneer in this field of looking at the plausibility of natural therapies in support of cancer patients. And she's been doing a really deep dive on the subject of coronavirus in her usual, very scrupulous way, science-based inquiry that is leading us to some practical recommendations for prevention and even treatment. She's an ND, a naturopathic doctor. She graduated from Brown University and received a doctoral degree from the Bastyr University. She's also she's past president of the Naturopathic Physicians Association, the AANP, American Association of Naturopathic Physicians. She is also immediate past president of the Oncology Association of Naturopathic Physicians. And she has co-authored two books, The Definitive Guide to Cancer and The Definitive Guide to Thriving After Cancer. And her CV is really too extensive for me to enumerate all her accolades. But importantly, she now has a faculty position at the University of Arizona, where she works at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine. And there she's engaged in research and teaching about applications of natural therapies to various health problems. And recently participated in a very, very informative webinar that was sponsored by the University of Arizona on the subject of the natural community's response to coronavirus. That was really excellent. I enjoyed that. Thanks for joining us today, Lise.
Well, thank you. Always a pleasure to be on your show, Ron.
Well, it is a great pleasure. And, you know, let's emphasize that in keeping with the spirit of your approach to cancer, we're not talking about alternative approaches. We're talking about integrative approaches that mesh well with a high-tech medical approach. You may want to start with a certain caveat about our state of knowledge about the application of natural therapies, you know, vitamins, minerals, and nutraceuticals to COVID-19, right?
Yes. You know, it's interesting because we're in a rather, I would say, both uncomfortable but also very exciting position. We have no human clinical data on integrative or natural therapies specific to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is the virus that produces the illness of COVID-19 infection. And so we have a body of data that's actually fairly extensive on natural therapies in relationship to other viral infections and even other coronaviruses, which are cousins of this one. So we can apply some of that knowledge and assume that there might be some effectiveness in this context, but we don't know for sure. But that's also exciting because there is, as I said, a large body of data. I mean, there are rather uncountable contenders for potential efficacy in terms of prevention and reducing the risk of complications from this illness from the natural world. So that's exciting. There's lots of opportunity out there. And of course, you know, the footnote to that is that we just don't know for sure what's effective, how much of something, if it is going to work, that we need to take. So there's definitely some guesswork in all this.
Indeed. And it's not enough to just say, and, you know, obviously there is a field of integrative immunology, the study of the way that natural compounds work on the immune system and may help us cope with infectious diseases. But it's not enough to simply extrapolate and say, okay, yeah, this, you know, elderberry is good for the flu, hence it's, you know, necessarily going to be applicable here, although it does suggest plausibility. And on it goes with traditional immune support nutraceuticals, you know, things like vitamin A and C and D and zinc and selenium, and on it goes. But each of these things has to be carefully vetted and individualized to the coronavirus situation, lest we misapply something which is either worthless or even potentially harmful. That's what I like about your approach to this.
Right. You know, and I think it's, we have a lot of historical lessons too. You know, many of the practitioners that have been around for a while are having memories of when HIV infection was starting. And at that time, similarly, there was this very scary disease that was occurring. There were no known treatments. There was no known way to prevent the disease other than safer sexual practices. And so there was a big opportunity to look at potential natural compounds, and it was a very similar situation where we took what we knew at that time for viral infections and applied it, and it was, you know, disappointing for a long time. And that was true for conventional medicine too. It wasn't really until people figured out that we had to use combination of therapies to get a handle on this virus that we made some headway with that disease. But I think we're in many ways in a similar position now with the coronavirus. We have some therapies that may have efficacy, but I think that as we learn more about this, there are going to be some that bubble up to the surface as being very, very impactful and very important. And there's going to be a lot that looked promising and that turn out not to be effective.
And indeed, I think the lesson of HIV is that in the absence of definitive therapies, people turned to all kinds of natural approaches and natural theories, some of which panned out. But ultimately, it was a conventional paradigm that seemed to not necessarily cure it, but keep the disease at bay. So it's not an either-or approach. It's the best of both worlds, an intelligent medicine approach that we need for this. True story, I actually, in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, I traveled to Washington, D.C., and I met with a young official at the Centers for Disease Control. His name was Anthony Fauci. I think you may have heard of him. He was a young, right. Expert at the National Institute of Allergy and Immune Disorders, NIAID. And I met with him at the behest of a couple of congresspeople who sought to advance natural practices in dealing with HIV. And this is actually the beginning of what's now called the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. They set up that center as part of the overall health response, the National Institutes of Health. And it's stood the test of time. But the AIDS epidemic was the impetus to begin studying natural approaches to disease. And, you know, Fauci listened. He was polite. And then he sort of demurred. And he said, well, you know, just like he's saying with hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil, he's saying, well, you know, that's all very interesting what you're talking about, you know, intravenous vitamin C and oxidative therapies. But we need to put those things to rigorous testing. And if they pan out, great. But it was almost like he sort of politely listened, nodded his head, then turned his eyes towards more definitive conventional treatments as a solution to the AIDS epidemic. That was about 35 years ago.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Well, thank you for meeting with him and, you know, doing what you did to help all of that get started. And, you know, I think one thing I would say, and perhaps in contradiction to what he's suggesting or maybe implying, is that, you know, while it's true, yes, we need to have clinical trials to really demonstrate the efficacy ultimately of some of these natural therapies. In the meantime, I think that because natural therapies, many of them anyway, not all, but many of them have such a high margin of safety and such a low risk, and so in that sense, rather than sitting around and doing nothing while we're waiting for those clinical trials, I think there is an opportunity to utilize things that have potential benefit and a very safe profile so that we can be proactively. It reminds me a little bit in the world of cancer, men who are diagnosed with early stage prostate cancer used to be put on what was called watchful waiting, which was a horrific terminology
wait
to describe
the other shoe to drop,
this.
You know. Yeah, we'll,
right, you know, and now it's fortunately been changed to active surveillance, which really implies more of an activity on the part of conventional medicine. But a lot of these men have taken it on to say, okay, now it's time for me to get proactive.
Major lifestyle change. Yeah.
Right. So I think in the same way we can approach COVID-19 and look for safe and possibly effective natural therapies.
And that's a great analogy. So, you know, when we're talking about coronavirus, I think it's important to discuss the possibility that there is not one single pathway to prevention and treatment. Is that we, and you've done this in your presentations, you've chunked our approaches into about four phases. One is to prevent infection. The other is, you know, once you're exposed and it's taken hold in your body, to stop the virus from replicating, or, you know, docking, you know, getting a hold in your, on your major organs and in your lungs. The third is to prevent this dread complication, which seems to be what's putting people on ventilators and killing people, the so-called cytokine storm. Because a lot of people have, you know, relatively mild cases. It's flu-like illness, and then they turn a corner. But other people, you know, after languishing for a few days with a fever, suddenly they find it hard to breathe, and they're rushed by ambulance to the hospital, where often it's too late. And then finally, stage four, and we really need to consider this, and I don't hear a lot of talk about, you know, strategies for this, something to hasten recovery, you know, strategies to prevent some of the post-viral complications that people might undergo, because, you know, we know that people who've had viruses develop chronic fatigue-like syndromes, they develop lung fibrosis if they've been on a ventilator. These are some things that, you know, it may differ. We need to customize our treatments according to what phase we're dealing with, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that that is really critical and within each of those phases. So you really did a nice job of describing what I found too in my research, which is that within that sort of initial, let's try to keep ourselves virus-free phase, there's sub-components, if you will, of how to do that. So the different ways in which we can try to prevent the virus from really taking hold. And then, as you described, if we do have the viral infection, then it's all about let's support, keep our immunity going, but at the same time, try to tamp it down so it doesn't get over-exuberant and perpetuate these complications. And then I think, you know, this convalescence is a really important, which we haven't even, in kind of a global sense, haven't gotten to this conversation, but I think that that's going to become very much on the forefront several months from now as we start to track some of the long-term sequelae. I think there's some initial data that's coming out of China where they're starting to look at this and finding that there's a higher rate, even in people that don't develop the severe forms of COVID-19, there seems to be an increased incidence of cardiovascular issues. And you mentioned lung issues. As we know from other seemingly benign viruses, there can be chronic fatigue and immune dysregulation. So I think we're going to really start to see, unfortunately, some of those things emerge as well.
Indeed. And it may be that nutraceuticals that are good for, you know, phase one and or phase two may not be so good, or even contraindicated, we don't know, for more advanced forms of this. So, you know, we have to be careful and selective in choosing strategies. You know, how we gather information on this is, you know, some of it is mechanistic. In other words, we look at plausible mechanisms, but that's sort of like looking at things on the drawing board. That's hypothetical. We also look at information that's we extrapolate from other viruses. We may say, well, you know, this is good for the herpes virus, but hence maybe it's plausible for this, but not necessarily. We also have there's a lot of test tube experiments. Recently, there was a study that looked at a drug for parasites called ivermectin, and it works great in the test tube. I mean, it just knocks the hell out of the coronavirus in a test tube, but do we know yet whether it's going to work in a human population? We need open trials or double-blind placebo-controlled studies to see. So, you know, this is how we're gathering data. Do you see, ultimately, the possibility that this needed work will be done around nutraceuticals, looking, say, at vitamin D levels or zinc levels or selenium levels in people who have COVID-19 and, you know, how they fared?
Gosh, that's a good question. I'm struggling on whether I should answer you realistically or optimistically. I guess I'll do both. So I think realistically, this is going to be a challenge, and I don't think there's going to be as much research in this area as we would like. There's a lot of, you know, right now, just the economic consequences of this pandemic are such that universities, for example, are really having to tighten up their research budgets and are prioritizing research in a very different way. So I think that the opportunity to look at things which have less plausibility, perhaps initially, or are more unfamiliar,
or perhaps
to
even
get
less
into
profitability,
trials,
you know, because
less profitability, right? So I think the chances of seeing a lot of that, like a whole slew of this coming forward, at least in the United States, is not great. Now, that being said, optimistically, I do think if we expand our research community to include the global research community, you know, over the past decade or so, there's certainly been much more research in integrative therapies coming out of the Middle East, coming out of Asia, and I think that if we look at those countries, we will see I'm expecting to see a glut almost of research in this area. So I'm excited for that.
Yeah, and some of it's coming out of China, and they're looking at traditional Chinese medicine because, I mean, let's face it, in China, for millennia, they've been dealing with viruses that cause pneumonia. And, you know, I'm sure you have, at the very least, a cursory understanding of TCM, traditional Chinese medicine. It's taught in naturopathic schools. And there are so many formulas that are addressed in kind of a nuanced way to pneumonias with different characteristics, you know, like a lot of phlegm production, a dry cough, et cetera, et cetera. And these are complex formulas with multiple ingredients. It's a little hard to test them one by one, like you might test a pharmaceutical drug. But there's an economic impetus to this, too, because China sells a lot of these TCM remedies across the world. And, you know, as part of national pride and prestige, but also as an economic engine, it's an industry there, and they want to validate it.
Exactly. Yes, and it is very exciting. I think that I have a colleague here in Tucson who's doing a very small pilot trial looking at two different TCM formulas, traditional Chinese medicine formulas, that have been used in China. One is for the prevention stage, and the other is more for once somebody has the infection. And I'm excited to see, you know, she's looking at this in some healthcare providers, so I'm excited to see what comes out of that. But I think that there is a lot of potential there. I think there's a lot of, I mean, just botanicals alone have so much potential in this regard. And if we look at historically, you know, before we had fancy drugs, the way the human's population kept itself going in the face of infection was really only through diet and maybe getting some good sleep and botanicals. So we know that there are things in this world that work. And I think we just have to, you know, figure them out.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks and practicalities. First of all, you know, actually in a very excellent article that you co-wrote along with Andrew Weil and some of your other colleagues at the University of Arizona, integrative considerations during the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, yeah, we talk about adequate sleep. We talk about stress management. But also diet is very important. And unfortunately, under the stress of this, I read an article in the New York Times today that said that sales of packaged foods and sort of nostalgia foods like Cheetos and Chef Boyardee in cans, you know, these are non-perishables, so people can stock up on them. It's kind of like survival food, are soaring. And yet sometimes the, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and produce is languishing, you know, in supermarket aisles. So what's the plausibility that diet can be a bulwark against either getting this or having or surviving it?
Yeah, so this is so important. I'm so glad you asked this. I really think that diet is very important, and you know, in two ways. Number one, let's start with where you finished, which is looking at processed, or what is often referred to now as ultra-processed food. Ultra-processed food really damages our body. Ultra-processed food has been shown to increase weight gain, disrupt metabolism and cellular health, increase the risk of cancer, and it's a very linear relationship, so that the greater the composition of one's diet that's taken up by ultra-processed foods, which is essentially anything that comes in a wrapper or a package, the greater the likelihood of dying prematurely, developing cancer, having unhealthy cells. So this is going to be directly impactful to thinking about people's defenses against viruses like the SARS-CoV-2, which we know is more likely to cause damage to the body when the cells aren't healthy to begin with, and there's some complex physiology underlying that. Maybe we'll just leave that aside for a moment, and just say that the opposite is also true. When we eat a diet that's plant-forward and that includes a copious amount of vegetable matter, we are imbibing not only minerals and vitamins and fiber, but we're getting some flavonoids. And flavonoids are pigmented compounds. They're what make fruits and vegetables so beautifully colorful. And these flavonoids are very important to our health. We've evolved as a species to rely on flavonoids, in fact, for controlling our inflammatory response, for increasing our immune defenses against infection.
For microbiome regulation,
for making sure that we have appropriate blood sugar balancing, which has now been shown to impact our susceptibility to the complications from SARS-CoV-2 infection. So these flavonoids are kind of hit all the points of protection. And so now, when we're sitting at home feeding ourselves out of our kitchens, it's really important to try to focus on vegetable matter. And it, you know, the recommendations have long been 7 to 10 servings a day, which most people read and they say, forget it, I'm not even close. But it's really not that difficult. As an example, to get 7 to 10 servings, which a serving would be, say, a cup of raw or one fruit and a half a cup of cooked vegetable. That each of those things would be one serving. So if in my breakfast I ate an orange along with whatever else I'm having for breakfast, that would be a serving. And then if for lunch I included a good healthy bowl of salad, that's typically 2 to 3 servings. So now I'm up to 4. And then with, let's say I have a snack, and in my snack I include some vegetables or maybe another fruit, now I'm up to 5.
Do they figure into this as well?
Well, vegetables and fruits, not technically, but they are so helpful for all the same reasons. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we can throw in some nuts. So let's say we have some nuts for snack. And then for dinner, we just have a good, you know, maybe at least a third, but ideally half of our plate has some vegetables, whatever form we want to take. We've done it. So, I mean, it's not crazily out of reach. Mm-hmm. We just need to really focus on it.
Indeed. And then, you know, there's this notion that metabolic syndrome, which covers a lot of bases, but it's associated with obesity, fatty liver, hypertension, and there's evidence that hypertensive patients have a unique susceptibility to this, and certainly diabetes. But diabetes is one of those tip of the iceberg things where, you know, there are people who are diagnosed with overt diabetes, but that may be the tip of the iceberg of the populace who has subclinical blood sugar dysregulation. It was Mark Hyman in a recent webinar. You know, I've been subsisting on great webinars lately, including your recent one, where he pointed out that it's estimated that a mere 12% of the U.S. adult population is metabolically fit. That means 88% of people have maybe not full bore type 2 diabetes, but they got excess body fat. They have borderline blood sugar that compromises their immune response and puts them at risk for more inflammation.
Right. And you actually sent an article to me recently which really went through the mechanisms that link diabetes or uncontrolled or elevated blood sugar specifically to the dangers of this COVID-19 disease. So it was really interesting because it's not just about immunity. There's other very specific mechanisms involving the ACE2 receptor, which is kind of the door that the virus uses to get into the cell. And that receptor being upregulated when sugar is high, and the sequelae, the respiratory distress being an inflammatory condition, also being aggravated by elevated blood sugar. So, you know, I think we have to really consider the fact that this metabolic unfitness, as you described, can really increase susceptibility to the infection, but also puts people at risk for the complications of infection.
Not to mention reduced what's called chemotaxis, which means that our white blood cells, which are like the little cellular Pac-Man defenders that gobble up invaders like viruses, literally become sluggish and lethargic in the presence of high blood sugar. So there's a lot of ways in which this metabolic unfitness can predispose people. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation about, you know, why disadvantaged populations are at higher risk. You know, some of them are service workers. They have a lot more time to spend on subways and buses to get to work and possibly get exposed. But also, particularly here in urban areas, among impoverished minorities, there's a much higher percentage of diabetes and hypertension and overweight. Because we've got a paradoxical situation in this country. It's poor people used to be, you know, too thin, and wealthy, prosperous people, you know, had that paunch, you know, which signified prosperity. The situation is reversed now. So, you know, we're seeing a disproportionate number of poor people being at risk for this disorder.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought that up because the disparities are a really important aspect, unfair aspect of this infection. And I hope this pandemic highlights the healthcare disparities in a way that will stimulate concerted efforts to really level the playing field. You know, I think that the issues you mentioned are true, and I would add to that that especially in urban areas, socioeconomically disadvantaged groups have food deserts. They have, you know, it's less safe for them to go out and exercise. There's a lot of social stress, and we know that psychological stress impairs immunity, among other things. So there's a lot of factors that are working against them to begin with.
So the silver lining to this epidemic is it may enhance our awareness of how these factors influence our health, and not just COVID-19, that the toll is terrible, but actually the toll is rather minuscule compared to the toll of degenerative diseases, you know, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and so on. All right, there's a good point at which to pause, Elise, because we've set the stage for a discussion of some specific interventions. Yeah, good diet, adequate sleep, stress management. But let's talk about some of the nutritional agents that have plausibility in the prevention and treatment of COVID-19. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, talking today to Lise Alschuler. She's an ND. She's also on the faculty of the University of Arizona, the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine. We'll be right back with more of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Stay with us.